This week's addendum is brought to you by Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like this podcast. So why are you still dealing with limited hours at the post office when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer whenever you need it, 24/7. Right now, use a promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial, plus $110 bonus offer, includes up to $55 in free postage. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter undisclosed. Once again, that's stamps.com, and enter undisclosed. This week's addendum is also brought to you by Frontline. Frontline's new season opener is certain to be captivating to undisclosed listeners. It's a 3-part serial aimed at finding the truth behind one of the worst terror attacks in modern history. My Brother's Bomber is about one man's obsessive quest to find the terrorist who killed his brother. The filmmaker's brother was on board Pan Am Flight 103 when it was blown out of the sky over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. 270 people died on Pan Am Flight 103, yet only one person was ever convicted for the crime. Filmmaker Kevin Dornstein travels across the globe in a relentless quest to solve the 27-year-old mystery. He's on a quest for answers, and he dives deep into case files, assembling a list of suspected plotters and tracking them for almost 5 years. With every episode, Dornstein encounters new witnesses and unearths fresh evidence that brings him closer to the truth about what really happened. This 3-part PBS series airs Tuesdays at 10, 9 Central, beginning September 29th. My Brother's Bomber aims to uncover who was really responsible for bringing down Pan Am Flight 103. You can check out previews and other information at www.pbs.org. And don't forget to catch the first episode on PBS at 10, 9 Central on September 29th. Hi, and welcome to Addendum 11 of Undisclosed, Sub Curia. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate attorney at the Volcal Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she also blogs at The View from LL2. Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, last week we discussed the plea deal that Jay was given by Kevin Urich, a plea that essentially prevented him from serving any jail time in exchange for his testimony. While his plea deal circumstances might have had some highly unusual factors, plea deals like this are struck all the time, and they're not that uncommon. Now, last week, though, the country was captivated when such a plea looked like it was going to result in the execution of an innocent man in Oklahoma. We have a number of listener questions, but we're going to start today's episode with the one about the Oklahoma death penalty case against Richard Glossop.
This question comes from Kim. Her Twitter handle is @KimberlyArtist. She asks, how similar is current case in Oklahoma, man to be executed today, to case of Adnan, i.e. the plea bargain twist?
She's referencing the case of Richard Glossop, who was scheduled to be executed in Oklahoma last Wednesday at 3 o'clock. Shortly before his execution, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals issued a 2-week stay so that they could consider a motion that had been filed by his attorneys raising new claims of innocence. I mentioned it last week because it's similar to this case in that we have a witness who is being told, if you don't testify how we want you to testify, you could wind up being executed. That witness then came back with a story implicating another person in the murder. In Glossop's case, it was a man named Justin Sneed who implicated him in the murder of Barry Van Treese, a motel manager who managed a motel where both Sneed and Glossop worked. There was no question that Sneed was involved in the murder. There was DNA evidence, physical evidence, circumstantial evidence. It was very conclusive that he was the one who actually did the deed. However, after questioning by detectives who told Sneed that they knew he hadn't done it alone and that they thought the Glossop had also been involved, Sneed developed a story, or several stories, in which he explained that Glossop had paid him to do the murder for him. So in that sense, the Glossop case is dissimilar from Anand's case and that the prosecutors had plenty of evidence to send Sneed away too. He was going to do time, and Sneed was ultimately sentenced to life in prison, although he didn't get the death penalty, and he's in a much nicer facility than he otherwise would have been. In Anand's case, by contrast, the prosecution didn't really have that kind of evidence against Jay. They had his statements, but there were problems with those statements, as we've discussed in detail, and they didn't really have anything else against him. Their only other witness, Jin Pusateri, had denied that Jay had any involvement in the actual burial. He just had known about it because Anand had told him.
I was just going to say, am I remembering this wrong, that in this case, they actually had Sneed's own confession on video. The police were basically leading him to implicate Glossop, but then that video tape was not admitted. Like, it wasn't his attorney screwed up and did not get the videotape before a jury.
Yeah, much like the audio tapes in this case of Jay's two interviews, the recorded interview of Sneed's confession was never introduced to the jury, despite the fact it did show that the cops were deliberately leading Sneed along and basically laying out a path for him to implicate Glossop in the murder. With Jay, things weren't as clear-cut. Far from it. I'm confident that if Urich could have sent both Jay and Anand away, he would have. But he didn't have the ammo to do that, so the deal that was ultimately worked out did not involve a life sentence for Jay. And in fact, it ultimately involved no time at all for Jay. That wasn't because Urich was feeling generous. It's because that's what he needed to do to make his case against Anand.
But it should show us at least what an uphill battle is in cases like this, that once somebody's been convicted and sentenced, even if the same witness, you know, recants their testimony, that sometimes the state doesn't budge.
Well, the new claims put forth by the defense in this case involved, first of all, expert testimony from a expert in false confessions who evaluated Sneed's statements and determined that they did not seem to be genuine confessions and were, in fact, false, and at least to the extent that they implicated Glossop. And they also received a statement from Sneed's daughter, who said that she believed her father did want to recant, but he was, for good reasons, scared to do so. His own deal would be in jeopardy then, and theoretically, he could also wind up on death row if he were to do so. And one of the other pieces of new evidence put forth was an affidavit from a prisoner who served time with Sneed. He said that it was kind of common knowledge in their group that Sneed had bragged about falsely implicating Glossop to send him away to save his own life, and that this prisoner, after seeing Glossop's case on the Dr. Phil show, had called Glossop's attorney to tell him what he knew and what he'd heard Sneed say about his confession.
Yeah, and so this last-second petition that was filed by Glossop's attorney, it's known as a successor petition, a successor because it's a successor to a prior post-conviction petition. It was to the Court of Criminal Appeals of Oklahoma, the highest court there on these issues. They've granted this stay of the execution until the 30th of September. Presumably, there'll be a hearing on this, but basically, the only way the court's going to do anything is if he essentially proves actual innocence. You might have seen in the media, and actually I got a Twitter question about this from Reagan Pasternak, Twitter handle at Reagan Pasternak. Governor Fallon, the governor in Oklahoma, said she had no legal authority to intervene with Glossop's execution. Is this the same for Baltimore in the Adnan Syed case? The answer is, I think Oklahoma has a pretty terrible procedure. Basically, Governor Fallon is correct. In Oklahoma, she can't grant clemency, meaning she can't commute the death sentence to life imprisonment or do anything else unless there's a recommendation by the Pardon and Parole Board. They didn't give that recommendation, so that governor can't step in and say, I think this person might be innocent. Let's not execute until we're absolutely certain. Maryland, it's much easier. The governor, under the Maryland Code of Correctional Services 7-601, can in fact pardon someone subject to any conditions the governor requires. So it's much easier for Maryland, the governor, to step in and say, I think this is injustice. I'm going to stop this death sentence. I'm going to maybe commute this sentence otherwise. Whereas Oklahoma, there's a lot more red tape to go through.
Yeah, and I haven't looked enough at this case to be able to say whether or not Glossop is innocent. However, everything I have seen causes me to deeply question the verdict here. And I hope to God they don't go through with the execution because it's a mistake that they cannot fix. And there are too many questions about the verdict to be comfortable with the death penalty in this case. I don't know how you guys feel, but oh gosh, well, this one's, I mean, Wednesday was tense for me.
Wednesday was bad for me. If you follow my Twitter account, you'll know exactly how I feel. And I was in the middle of a talk when a student at the law school I was at said that the execution was stayed, and I finally breathed a sigh of relief. But again, the clock, he's back on the clock. Less than 2 weeks.
Can't put aside the fact that this is a case the Supreme Court of the United States heard earlier this year based upon a shortage in the drug that has been used in lethal injection. Oklahoma has been using midazolam, and there's real questions about whether, in fact, that's an effective sedative or whether a person who is given that as one of the drugs in the lethal cocktail can literally feel their body burning from the inside from these drugs. And it's, from many sources, just a horrible process, this drug. And so it's not just, is he guilty or innocent? There's real questions on that. There's real questions about whether this drug protocol in Oklahoma is unnecessarily cruel.
So our next Twitter question comes from S. Mame, whose Twitter handle is @S. Mame. And this person asks, really concerned about Jay's constitutional rights? And how many other cases did Urick arrange for defense counsel for a witness? This person is referring to Urick's statements about why he helped procure Anne Benaroya to represent Jay during the plea deal. And he essentially said that he was concerned to make sure that Jay had his constitutional rights fulfilled. And so I think that's the question here is, did he have the same level of concern for other defendants?
I'm not sure anyone believes Urick's explanation here because it doesn't make any sense. And it's not... If Urick was really motivated by a concern for this particular witness's constitutional rights, a witness that he believed was a murderer, he would not have gotten involved by even creating an appearance of impropriety by introducing him to his attorney and recommending her services to him. Jay would have gotten representation by a public defender. His constitutional rights weren't at issue. So whatever his motivation was, it wasn't what he said.
You were going back through Urick's statements at trial. In fact, he mentions that Benaroya wasn't the first person that he contacted about representing Jay, right?
Not the first. There's at least one other.
On the record, Urick mentions how he had talked to another attorney before he contacted Benaroya. From the records, it looks like Mr. Joya, we're guessing that's Antonio Joya, who is now the deputy state's attorney in Baltimore. And interestingly enough, the Freddie Gray case, everything going on there, he actually is one of the SAs who is prosecuting that case.
We don't know exactly what Joya would have testified to had he testified at trial because Judge Heard decided she didn't need to hear from him. Urick offered to make a proffer of what he would have testified about, but again, she didn't want to hear it. So all we know at this point is that Urick had also approached Joya to meet Jay, an indigent defendant who he thought needed representation. And for some reason, Joya decided not to go through with it.
It would be interesting to find out why, but I don't think we will.
But it does sort of support that whatever the cops are telling Jay was based on a plan that they and Urick had agreed upon or had discussed, because it does kind of look like that Urick had intended for multiple attorneys to be there that morning for Jay to choose from. Possibly, but for whatever reason, the only attorney who was there was Anne Benaroya, and after she met Jay and saw what a fix he was in, she chose to represent him pro bono in order to help him escape the bind he found himself in. Our next question comes from Jessica Scott, whose Twitter handle is @JessTrough. She writes, can you please explain sub curia again in relation to non?
Yeah, so sub curia, it's a Latin term. It translates as under law or under consideration. This is what we mentioned in episode 11, how Jay's plea deal wasn't complete on September 7th. Why that's important is, and we talked to Benaroya about this, is that you might look at the case initially, and this is kind of what we did, and say, well, how is it that she advised Jay on September 7th in a couple of hours to accept this plea deal? Well, the fact that it was sub curia and it wasn't completed, Benaroya says the meaning of that is that she could withdraw from the plea after it was initially started on September 7th. And the reason why she wanted to have that in the plea agreement was she needed to complete discovery. She needed to go through all the evidence in the files in a relatively short period of time. And so that's sort of the basic importance of that, is that that explains why this was so quick, was that it wasn't a completed plea deal, and it gave defense counsel time after initially starting this process to review everything and decide, okay, the options again are it gets kicked to Baltimore County, it's a death penalty case for murder one, or does it make more sense to have the plea to accessory after the fact and either no criminal term or a very light criminal term?
Our next Twitter question comes from Susan A. Walsh, whose Twitter handle is @SusanAWalsh. And Susan asks, how did Benaroya not know Jay's change in the Intercept interview? Didn't she arrange it? And so just to refresh your memory, Jay gave an interview to The Intercept. And in that interview, he changed some key parts of his story once again. He changed the place where the trunk pop happened. He said he wasn't at the burial site. He said that Adan called him before he came to his grandmother's house at midnight, which is where he says now the trunk pop happened. And I'll be honest, before we get into, you know, Benaroya's response on this, and I actually blogged about this, I was so struck by the fact that, number one, we know that his lawyer did apparently help arrange, make the interview, and then the same publication interviewed Urich. So I naturally assumed a connection between, and some kind of coordination between all three of them, between Urich and Benaroya and Jay. And I also assumed, as a lawyer, I personally would not be allowing a client to talk to media unless I knew what they were going to say, at least, you know, review it with them. So I assumed that Benaroya had done so, and I couldn't understand why Jay's statement changed again. So let's hear Benaroya's response, because it was a surprise to me, and then I can explain what I thought had happened.
Yeah, so basically what Benaroya told me was, let's go back to the summer of 2014. We all heard this on Serial. Sarah, Koenig, and Julie go to Jay's house unannounced and try to interview them, try to interview Jay. He allows them in, he starts to talk, and eventually asks them to leave without going on the record. So then we can go to October or November in 2014. Sarah calls up Benaroya and asks for her to put Jay in contact with her so that he can talk to her. And according to Benaroya, this is the first she had heard or thought about the case in over a decade. She had last met with Jay and represented him back in 2002. That was a probation violation of his accessory conviction based upon a marijuana charge. And that was it. She hadn't had any contact with Jay or his case in years. And in fact, she initially confused the case with a nightclub shooting case, that case that she was working on with Urich when she was introduced to Jay. And that's why she told Sarah that her introduction to Jay couldn't have happened the way that Jay described it, because she was confusing the two cases. But basically, this is the first knowledge she has of the case in years. And at that point, Sarah is trying to get to Jay through Benaroya. And basically, Benaroya says, well, if you want, you can have Jay contact me. Jay calls Benaroya about 3 weeks later and, you know, asks what he should do. Basically, and this, you know, this is coming from Jay, we're not sure whether this is accurate or not, he would have been fine giving the interview to Sarah, but he was very unhappy and distressed about the way that she came to the house unannounced. If you look to the Intercept interview, you can see exactly what he's talking about there. And so Benaroya thinks, well, you know, there's this story, it's out there, it's painting you in a bad light. If you want to talk, I work in civil rights, I have certain contacts. Based upon that, that's how the Intercept interview was set up. But in 2014, Benaroya was not Jay's attorney. She hadn't looked at the case. That's all she did, was she simply put Jay in contact with the Intercept. She had no knowledge about the content, the questions, no control whatsoever about what happened with Jay or Urich.
And I'll admit, to me, it sounds odd, too, that anyone involved in this case would not have paid attention to Serial or followed up with what's happened after. But Benaroya is not the only one. I've talked to other witnesses who have likewise either listened to only selected episodes of Serial Undisclosed or just haven't listened at all. So, I found it funny, too, but she's far from the only one that, for whatever reason, didn't want to follow up.
Yeah, and she's not involved in the criminal milieu anymore. She's an animal rights attorney, basically. Since around 2000, she has been working at the Maryland Animal Law Center. She hasn't been involved in criminal cases. And again, she hadn't looked at the case in a while and hasn't really followed until we've talked to her any of the details. She had very little recollection of the specific facts of the case.
So I definitely was surprised to hear this because I have become increasingly convinced that Jay, from 1999 onwards, basically has been telling the story that he thinks people want to hear, like the police or the prosecutor want to hear, and saying, you know, and I thought in this case, that's probably what happened is like, if anybody's following the case and they understand now that, you know, the timeline just couldn't work the way it was stated by the prosecution or Jay in 2000, that they would have to shift the timeline if it went back to court. And I thought personally that this was some kind of strategic move in case they have to go to trial again, that they would say, oh no, now we're going to change it again because, you know, we know there's lividity issues, there's other issues that would show that it just couldn't have happened like that. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but those were my thoughts. But anyhow, I'm actually relieved to hear that that's not how it went.
And I still think it's very likely, if not all but certain, that the prosecution knew of the lividity issues back in 99. These issues would have come up then too. And it's, to me, very likely that Yurik or other parts of the prosecution or the investigators have asked Jay about them. Our next question is from Bringer Stell, whose Twitter handle is @BringerStell, who writes, how do you explain police department and Yurik misconduct? Multiple Brady violations, concealing Crime Stoppers call, and interview records, plus Massey.
Yeah, and speaking of these multiple violations involving Massey, you might recall that in episode 11, we discussed the Harris case. Again, that's the case where Robert Harris was convicted of murder based upon allegedly hiring Russell Brill to kill his fiancée. We noted how his first conviction was thrown out because the state failed to disclose that Brill's plea deal was a little bit sweeter than the jury was led to believe at trial. Well, then in 2012, Harris was again tried and convicted of the murder of his fiancée a second time. But after he was convicted, he appealed, and specifically he claimed that the state failed to provide him with material information that he could have used to impeach or call into question the credibility of the lead detective on the case, none other than Daryl Massey, again, that same detective who allegedly received the anonymous calls in Adnan's case. The information, we touched upon this a bit before in an addendum, was that Internal Affairs was investigating whether Detective Massey was doctoring his timesheets to get overtime pay. And in fact, here's a quote from a Baltimore Sun article. It was about six different Baltimore police officers being investigated for this type of fraud. Quote, the highest paid of the six, Sergeant Daryl Massey, earned a base salary of $71,361. With overtime, he took home $141,000 in the last fiscal year, which ended June 30th, the city records show. In fact, there was some merit to this investigation. There was surveillance done on Massey, and one day when he had submitted an overtime slip where he claimed that he had worked nonstop from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., surveillance actually showed he was at his house, whereupon he left and went shopping at a Food Lion, a grocery store. So based upon that, this just happened about 2 weeks ago, September 2nd. Harris's second conviction was thrown out based upon the state's failure to disclose that this investigation was being done into Detective Massey and falsifying his work records to get overtime.
This isn't the only case where Massey's prior misconduct has resulted in cases being overturned. In the case of Darnell Pooh Fields and Clayton Coco Coakley, who were both charged with one count of first-degree murder and the attempted murders of Yvette Hawley and William Quartz, although neither Hawley nor Quartz identified Fields or Coakley as shooters, they ended up being convicted, with that conviction later getting thrown out due to an error by the judge. They were then tried again. However, that conviction was also thrown out, this time due to the state's failure to disclose this overtime investigation to the defense and to allow cross-examination into it. So that's at least two separate cases, three convictions, where Massey's misconduct has resulted in murder charges being thrown out.
Before we wrap up, I want to give special thanks to Heidi Phelps, who's created a couple of visually stunning, detailed, and information-packed timelines for us. You can find these timeline graphics on our website, www.undisclosed-podcast.com. There is a general timeline as well as a Crime Stoppers timeline. And, you know, I know we often have a lot of details. There are a lot of things in this case to keep straight. So these graphics are perfect to help you keep track of the tons of information that we keep throwing at you. And we're going to have a new one up today for Hayes Day. So you can find that along with the other ones again on our website. Now, we had mentioned in our last episode that we would next be taking a close look at the defense witness who had disappeared by the time the trial rolled around. And we will be looking at him, but just not next week. Next week, we have a special treat for our listeners. Most of us listen to Serial, and now Undisclosed, without ever having experienced the criminal justice system firsthand. But next week, we will meet a group that understands the system, the players, and the issues much better than we may ever hope to. We'll meet a group of inmates who have been listening to the podcast and following the case all along from inside prison walls. Next time on Undisclosed. A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @UndisclosedPod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.